Previously on Beta.
What we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach.
I just started playing. And the bass player came in. And then the guitar player came in. And the rhythm was there.
You're despicable.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we explore the history of hip-hop and how it became the most popular music genre in the U.S.
Ultimately, it was when the music went on record that the voice became the prominent thing and people were looking at rappers as kind of the core of the culture.
Rapper and broadcaster Shad joins us to talk about his Peabody Award-winning Netflix series, Hip Hop Evolution. And digital media professor Janet Murray tells us how the computer is reshaping the stories we live by.
Groundhog Day takes the same situation and repeats it, but it is really well designed to make the different versions comment upon each other.
Comedian Chris Gethard has a history of putting his own spin on stand-up comedy. He once staged a tournament where two comedians would have 5 minutes to be funnier than the other one. The winner advanced, and the loser was shot with a paintball gun. Chris used to think his ideas were too weird, but not anymore. He's written a memoir in which he encourages us to embrace failure. It's called Lose Well. Chris says that the best advice he ever got was from his therapist.
Basically, when I first came to her, it was 2007. I'd been, you know, banging my head against the wall trying to be a comedian for 7 years at that point. And when I was that age, that felt like forever. I mean, I was 26, 27 years old. 7 years was a big chunk of my life, and I wasn't getting anywhere. And I was hitting that stage that many of us do where I started to watch my friends go everywhere. And it was that line I had to walk between, you know, joy for my friends, but also a lot of panic for me. And that panic was really taking over my life. Hence why I sought out a therapist. And she made it really clear, you got to give yourself no other option at some point. You either go all in or you don't, but you don't just sit on the fence forever. Meaning, for me, she said, cut off every source of income you have that's not the type of thing you would want to do, whether that's acting or performing or writing comedy. Mm-hmm. And I explained to her that it was a very bad idea because I paid my rent through all my freelance gigs. And she said, well, you can pay your rent forever and sit here panicking, or you can go all in. And she made something very clear, which has proven true to me in my life, which was, if you take this big swing and it doesn't work out, you're going to be a lot happier than you are sitting in the middle ground.
Mm-hmm. You ask yourself the following question early on in your book, Lose Well. So if I recognize the success in my professional life these days, why would I promote failure instead? So let me ask you that very question. Why are you promoting failure instead of success?
I think, especially as Americans, we are raised to have this idea of you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you go make things happen. And I think there's some real nobility to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some real good advice in that. But I also think that it makes this issue very binary, very black and white, very much like this idea of you win or you lose and that's that.
Yeah.
And I think that when you commit to the idea that you might fail, and in fact that when you do fail that that's okay, you start to find a middle ground. And the middle ground has so many more layers to it than that. It's got such a broader spectrum of possibility than that. And what I have seen over and over again in my own life and in people around me who work in creative fields, non-creative fields, what I've seen over and over again is that when you embrace the idea that you might fail, you very often get to happiness quicker. Things like that I was becoming known for.
As you say in your book, you thought your weird ideas were a roadblock to a successful career, when in reality, they were your greatest asset because they were unique to you. So why did you not have more confidence in your ideas?
Well, it's not easy to be a weird person. It's not.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I think a lot of us feel it. I think a lot of people probably just nodded their heads, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not easy to be the weird one. And I had to realize that. Like I was saying before, a lot of my friends, they were just out and out hilarious. They were better looking than I was. They were taller than I was. They had looks that lent themselves to being on TV more than I did. What do I got left in my comedy career? I'm a weird guy. I'm an admittedly strange guy. And, you know, I sat around apologizing for those ideas, feeling like they were dumb or silly in the hopes that maybe I could turn into something I wasn't. And turn into one of those people who's going to meet with traditional success. And then when I realized that wasn't going to happen, I think at a certain point I said, you know what? I think I'm pretty proud to be the ugly duckling. I wish I didn't spend all those years apologizing for it. Maybe I wouldn't have been so stressed out.
Yeah, yeah. You have this great description about why you didn't have more confidence in your ideas that really ring true to me, and I think would ring true to our listeners. You said right that it makes sense that your most unique ideas feel terrifying because they're creatively risky and they also expose the inner workings of your brain. You have to learn to turn off the self-doubt about these ideas, which I think that's very true. That just really nails it right there. So how did you learn to turn off the self-doubt about these ideas? Just was it the way people reacted and people said, hey, that's a cool idea, Chris. Was it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, even that didn't get through. I mean, these shows would sell out. These shows would be met with people being really enthusiastic, and I still felt so, I would cringe afterwards, and I think, well, what if someone from the industry saw that? Mm. I can't have that. It's okay if this guy's kids drinking cans of beer in a basement in New York like it, but I got to clean up my act. So it took a long time. And I actually, as many things in my life happened, someone pulled me aside. The artistic director of the theater I worked at, he was a good friend of mine. Years before he had that job, he and I were friends. And he's the one who said to me, he goes, you gotta make a show that's just this stuff. This is what everybody loves from you. Why aren't you just embracing it? And he forced me to name it The Chris Gethard Show, which proved to be a huge, huge benefit to my career, the idea that I branded my name on this idea of this sort of like aggressive New York weirdness comedy. And it took me way too long, and I was pretty obtuse, and there were many times where I could have embraced who I was and I didn't. And one of my major goals in writing this book is the idea that maybe if I just lay all that out and kind of look at my past and provide it as any sort of information or blueprint for people coming up after me, maybe they'll spend less time apologizing for who they are. Maybe they'll waste less hours, less days, less years feeling self-conscious, and maybe they can kind of skip to the front of the line as far as doing it punk rock style and doing it themselves and creating their own avenues.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Chris Gethard Show, which you started doing in 2009. Do you have a favorite example of a weirdest idea that you did on the show?
I mean, well, that with that show, there's every episode was weirder than the last. It kind of became this community-driven attempt to top ourselves. What was the weirdest moment? I mean, there was one time where a random studio audience member came on camera when we were still on public access and started beating me with a flog. That was not a great moment in my life. What else? I've had kickboxers beat me up. I've had dominatrixes beat me up. I've been doused in almost every substance. We once did a bit called The Human Crane, where my effort was to make myself the claw in a big human-sized version of the claw machine game from
arcade.
And yeah, almost got dropped on my head and broke my neck.
Oh, dear.
Did a lot of strange stuff on that show. Pretty proud of it.
No, no pressure at all. If you mess up, it's just perhaps the end of my career. So what do you want to show us? What's your weird body? What are we thinking here?
Well, you said show us the weirdest part of your body, but mine's actually a missing body part. I'm missing my two front teeth.
Okay, I'm wide awake. Alana Glay. Alana Glay, so happy.
Naomi, how'd that go down?
Well, when I was 12, I had a diving board accident.
Ooh.
And I won't really go into it, but I damaged my four front teeth. 6 years later, they were dying, and then they got pulled last summer.
They got pulled last summer. I think you look great both ways, first of all.
I would never have known.
Never have known.
Never have known. And I'm also like, that's so dope. I would use that all the time.
Yeah,
I would go
You say that one of the most frequent dream killers we often use is that no one will get it anyway. Why do you think we so often use this as an excuse to talk ourselves out of our pursuing it, our dreams? Just because it's easy? It's easier to give up than to press on?
Yeah, I mean, I think when things look difficult, it's very often tempting to find the pressure release that gets you out of it. Mm-hmm. And saying, oh, everybody will think it's weird anyway, is one that's always kind of sitting on the top of our tongue.
Yeah.
It's weird because I've written a self-help book, but it's all based on actual personal experience. And I'd like to think that I'm no sort of guru. And I think you can hear that in my voice. I'm just trying to lay out what happened for me. I think when you stop saying that idea of, you know, oh, man, everybody will think my idea is so weird. And when you start realizing that that might be an asset, what happens is that the weirdos who like it, they really like it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They stick with you forever. You become their person.
Oh, sure.
You
know,
I'm not the most popular comedian in the world by a long shot. And very often when I get press, you look at the comment sections, people will be going, this guy's not very funny. But then you'll see the people who do like me and they'll go, oh, well, I would take a bullet for this guy's work. So back off. And I think there's something to be said for a smaller idea that feels very honest and true, that the people who connect with it so hard.
Right.
I think that is something that should be a point of pride.
You've had this mantra for the past 10 years that you say is, you describe it as goofy and a little embarrassing. It's a two-word phrase that you always say to yourself when you're writing, strategizing, or thinking big. What is it?
Oh, funny plus, of course. That's one of my favorite chapters. That's become a very informative thing to me. That's just the idea that you should, at the end of the day, seek to raise the bar, not just meet it. We often, when you start out at something, you're bad at it. Mm-hmm. So you want to just get good at it. So you look around at the people who are good at it, and you go, I want to be as good as they are. And I would say, no, try to be better than they are. And I'd argue the way to do that is add something to it.
So let's talk a bit about how this idea of Funny Plus has influenced some of your most popular work, starting with Career Suicide, your 2017 HBO special based on your off-Broadway show of the same name.
Right. Well, you know, Career Suicide dealt very much. I think it's a very funny show. I stand by the funny parts. But it also has a lot of stretches where I talk honestly about what it's like to be in therapy, to have depression, to be on medication, to have had suicidal thoughts. It gets very, very dark. So I'd like to think that the funny parts of that one are extremely funny, but it's funny plus uncomfortable, funny plus disturbing, funny plus sad, funny plus overly honest in some people's eyes. It's aiming to add some elements to the platform of humor that you don't normally attach to it. See what I can get away with. And
yeah.
I think that one hit a lot of people in the guts in a way I'm very proud of.
Yeah. How has Funny Plus influenced your podcast, Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People?
Well, in my podcast, the whole show is I just take a phone call and I talk to someone for an hour. They never tell me their name. I'm not allowed to hang up. It's as simple as that. And I thought it was going to be kind of an extension of my TV show where people would be prank calling me. I figured it'd be, you know, a lot of college kids and high school kids just messing with me. It instead became a thing where people would tell me their dark secrets. People tell me their stresses. And I realized it's funny. Plus, it's very empathetic. It's not the funniest project I do because I've learned that it's about the callers. It's not about me. And there's times where the callers are bringing up stuff that is not funny at all. And I have to sort of sit on my instincts as a comedian and let it be what it wants to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, on its best day where that balance is there, I think I'm a funny guy. I'm looking for some laughs. But also, it's very empathetic. It's very listening-based. It's funny, plus it has this layer of empathy.
Is there one particular episode of Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People that you're especially proud of?
There's one that came out recently, just a few months ago. It was someone who was a survivor of the mass shooting in Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
She had been attending that music festival when that very, very sad, twisted incident happened. And she told us for an hour, sort of beat by beat, what happened. Her husband had been a medic in the military, so he sort of pushed her behind some cover, and he took off to run into the fray to help victims, and she was so scared for her husband, and there's this kind of chaotic scramble to get out of there, and it's a pretty intense beat-by-beat breakdown of what that day was like for her, and it's hard to listen to. It's also pretty surprising at points. She, you know, talks about some of her reactions to it in a way that I didn't expect.
August 4th marked 58 days until the one-year anniversary. And 58 is kind of an important number because that's how many people were killed.
58.
So in honor of the 58 people, myself and a lot of the other warriors have started a journey doing 58 random acts of kindness in honor of each person that was killed.
Wow.
And yeah. So, you know, I haven't smiled so much, you know, in the last year or so than when I'm doing my random acts of kindness.
But I'll tell you, the thing I'm most proud of with it is that it's just one person's experience. Mm. And it really is just her telling us what her experience was. There's a lot of things in this world now that by the time you or I or anyone listening hears about them, they have been placed through a politicized lens.
Yeah.
And I was very, very proud to be able to have someone tell that story in their own words, first person, and their reactions to it, first person, in a way that wasn't filtered through the opinions of a platform that had motives beyond just telling the story.
Yeah. Near the end of your book, you say that we should make it a lifelong goal to always be terrified. What do you mean?
I think that there's a lot of truth in that. That, I think, is one of the most basic pieces of advice I can give in this book that's undeniable, which is you start out at something. It feels really daunting. It feels impossible. And if you work hard enough and you put your head down and you're willing to run into enough walls, eventually you run through the wall. You start to realize, oh, it's possible because I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And then you go, now let me try to do it at a level that I'm proud of, and now let me keep going. And at a certain point, you'll realize, oh, this is not scary at all anymore. If you get to a point where you feel proficient at your dream, to the point where it no longer terrifies you every day, replace that terror in your life. For me, I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, the martial art, which I promise you, if anybody could see me, I'm a visible wimp. And I say that with pride. I am to the naked eye. If you walked past me on the street, you'd go, that man is a wimp. And I go and I wrestle stronger, younger people 4 days a week. This morning I was wrestling a 22-year-old man who weighs 175 pounds. I'm 38. I weigh 145 and I'm tired. Like, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. But as I've become more proficient at comedy, I want to remember what that fire in the gut feels like to just be bad at something and frustrated by it and uncertain if it's ever going to work out. I think that those are feelings that can be unhealthy if we let them, but they can be very productive and very healthy if we utilize them.
Chris Gethard is a comedian, podcast host, and the author of Lose Well. You can find out more about Chris at WPR.org/beta.
When we think about hip-hop now, we think about it as, you know, like Chuck D said, the CNN of the street. You know, we think about it as music with a message. It absolutely opened up possibilities for hip-hop music.
Hip-hop artist Shad Cabango explains how Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five changed the course of music history with their 1982 hit, The Message. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Shadrach Cabango is better known as the hip-hop artist Shad. He's also the host of the Netflix documentary series Hip Hop Evolution. The series won a Peabody Award in 2016. The jurors said it chronicled how music born in the poorest neighborhoods of urban America became a global phenomenon. Shad says that it all started on August 11th, 1973.
Yes, so that's kind of the accepted birth of hip-hop because that is when Kool Herc threw a party for his sister. And it's considered the birth of hip-hop because Kool Herc played particular records in a particular style that is kind of the backbone of hip-hop. And what that style is a mix of records from different genres, some funk, some soul, reggae. Kool Herc was from Jamaica. And he was playing the sections of records that they called breaks. So it was the breakdown part of the record. Usually a breakdown of drums and bass or something like that, some funky kind of percussion.
I've never seen anyone have two copies of a record. And keep going back to the part where we normally would pick the needle up and put it back, so there's this silence for a minute. Now that was continuous, and he called it the merry-go-round.
Yeah, it was hip-hop's Big Bang moment. And I've read that DJ Kool Herc, he plays two copies of James Brown's 1970 album Sex Machine and did a cut and mix of the percussion breakdown from the song Give It Up or Turn It Loose. Is that right?
Well, the funny thing is, to this day, you can see it in hip-hop evolution, like, Kool Herc doesn't like to talk about the particular records that he played because that's how DJs were at that time, right? You know, people came to their parties because of their record collection. And so it's kind of funny, even to this day, he doesn't like to disclose. But you could call James Brown really a godfather of hip hop because his break beats are so fundamental, foundational to the music. Oh, get it.
And I heard that Sugar Hill Gang were at that party, right? And they went straight home and wrote Rapper's Delight, and the rest is history.
not quite.
No, yeah. who were some of the other early DJs that contributed to the birth of this new kind of music?
Yeah, well, the kind of the accepted trinity is Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Flash. Mm. Bambaataa, one thing he's credited with is bringing community into it, is bringing this sort of ethos of hip-hop being about unity and about knowledge and empowerment. And then Grandmaster Flash, I think you could speak of him as like the real technical innovator, because what he did was he made that whole looping thing with the breakbeats super smooth.
Most DJs, they concentrated their efforts on the tone arm. It would be totally sloppy offbeat, and I seen a lot of that. I knew there has to be a better way. And after trying many different things, I placed my fingers on the vinyl. I let it go, stopped it. Let it go, stop it. I said to myself, I have absolute control of the record.
And then how did the rhymes, the lyrics, the rapping, how did that start?
Yeah, that's a good question. And in the documentary, what we talk about is how, well, in a sense, that's been around for a long time, obviously, the use of the voice in a rhythmic way, call and response kind of way. That goes back to a lot of different traditions. But with hip-hop specifically, we talked to Coke LaRock, who was the MC at Kool Herc's parties. And so in those really early times, the DJ is really what people came to the party for. And the MC was the guy kind of bigging up the DJ, shouting out people at the party, just creating a kind of party atmosphere.
See, I used to do like this, my man Reggie would be. I'd be like, yo, Reggie, go move your car. You double parking, rah-rah, you know. And we like 16, the girls be like, oh, he got a car. So when you come back in, the girls are like, you ain't got no car, you know?
And then that sort of evolved to more people getting on the mic and doing their little couplets and groups. So crews were a big thing in the early days of hip hop. So that evolved to, you know, 2-3 people doing a routine together to kind of get the party going. But ultimately, it was when the music went on record that the voice became the prominent thing and people were looking at rappers is kind of the core of the culture.
Yeah. Let's fast forward a few years to 1979 then, and the hip-hop track Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. What role did this song play in the history of hip-hop?
Yeah, huge. A really interesting story because hip-hop at that time, you know, it was a spontaneous thing. And a lot of the people that were at the forefront at that time in the Bronx and in Harlem, they didn't really imagine this being something you could capture on record. And Rapper's Delight was that first record. I think it sold like 20 million copies. I mean, it just probably one of the biggest selling singles of all time. But there was a record producer, and she put together a group of kids she met in New Jersey.
Yeah, and what's her name? I can't remember her name.
Sylvia
Robinson?
Robinson.
Yeah, that's right.
So these weren't kids that were part of the crews that everybody involved with hip-hop knew And they put this record together, and it took over the world. It really spread hip-hop everywhere. If you go to other cities, that's where they encountered hip-hop.
Yeah,
outside of New York, they encountered hip-hop with Rapper's Delight.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta...
What did other New York MCs think of it?
They hated it. They really, really hated it.
Like, what are they doing to our art form? You know what I mean? It's like, this is the first introduction that people get to what we do, to what we've been doing for like 7 years.
You hated it. That was the worst piece of stupid song that everybody liked. And then people would come to us and say, you know, y'all need to make a record like that. And we'd be like, well, how are we gonna make a piece of like that?
From sun to sun and from day to day, I sit down and write a brand new rhyme, because they say that miracles never cease. I've created a devastating masterpiece. I'm gonna rock the mic.
How many of the lyrics to Rapper's Delight were stolen?
So Grandmaster Caz, who's considered one of the greatest MCs ever, and basically him and Melly Mel were considered the best rappers in the world. He wrote, I guess, a good third of that song. I mean, you can even hear the name Casanova spelled out. Casanova Fly. I mean, that's Cas.
Come on and sing that song. Check it out. I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y.
Yeah, I see. Cool. Rapper's Delight was, as you say, the nation's introduction to hip-hop, and it was kind of a compilation of lyrics from that scene that created the genre. But then there was a seismic sonic shift in 1982 when Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five released The Message. Can you tell me a bit about this song and how it redefined hip-hop?
Yeah, well, hip-hop was, you know, going back to Kool Herc and what we were talking about in 1973, it was party music.
Mm-hmm.
The Message spoke to what was going on in the community in a really frank and poetic way.
And we've got a story about some music that's being heard across the land.
New young black group. They are called, this group, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. Their sound and their fury prove their music could be used to get across a serious message. Not coincidentally, the name of their song is The Message, a hard-edged anthem of the urban ghetto.
It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
It's information. It's game. It's knowledge. That was very attractive to me.
It was reaching down to kids like me and saying, hey, this is where you're gonna end up if you don't have a plan.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkie in the alley with the baseball bat. Tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with the tow truck repossessed my car. You know, them lines like that is ferocious, they poignant, they need to be said. Don't push me, because I'm close to the edge.
When we think about hip-hop now, we think about it as, you know, like Chuck D said, the CNN of the street, you know? We think about it as music with a message. It absolutely opened up possibilities for hip-hop music.
In one episode of Hip-Hop Evolution, you describe Run DMC as the Beatles of hip-hop. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think they were the first real hip-hop stars, firstly because of, you know, the big records that they had, but also because of their style. So they dressed the way people dressed in the streets. They really carried that whole aesthetic, and then combine that with the hit records, My Adidas, Sucker MCs, It's Like That, and then, of course... It's like they were, hip-hop's first rock stars, I'd say.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Run DMC was part of hip-hop's so-called golden age. What was it about this time, the mid to late 80s, that made it such a great time for hip-hop?
Yeah, well, what people love about that era is that the genre just evolved so much and so quickly. And every time an artist would come out during that era, whether it was Rakim.
On the arsenal, I got artillery, lyrics and ammo, rhymes and rhythm, then I'm gonna give him piano.
Or De La Soul.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, tell me, mirror, what is wrong?
Or A Tribe Called Quest.
Can I kick it? Can I kick it? Can I kick it to all the people who can quest like
Public Enemy, certainly.
89, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer.
So it's like this rapid evolution of the music. So many new styles got introduced. So people really consider that to be the golden age of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. I think hip-hop is now known as much for its political power as it is for its party preparedness. I'm thinking especially of a group like Public Enemy. How did Public Enemy influence hip-hop?
Well, let's start with sonically. You know, they really just came with the Bomb Squad, the production team.
Fight the power!
You got these textures musically that were just so powerful. And then you had Chuck D, who was this amazing MC with this big booming voice and a really strong, clear message. And they inspired so many people after them. So, yeah, Public Enemy is a game changer, one of the greatest groups ever in hip-hop.
Yeah. As the 80s became the 90s, gangster rap attracted a lot of attention, and it was also a product of Los Angeles. So how significant was it for hip-hop to become bi-coastal?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's difficult to remember these things now. Hip-hop was very New York-centric, so when gangster rap emerged, I think one of the most significant things about it was this L.A. movement. It became the dominant kind of subgenre of hip-hop. It was killing it on the charts with the record sales and getting a ton of media attention because the content was so hardcore, and that was absolutely the product of the realities in Los Angeles of gang life there and all the violence there and the police brutality there. And it spoke to that stuff with a frankness and with a sonic heft that people hadn't heard before.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Speaking of gangster rap, one of the most influential and controversial groups at that time was N.W.A. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Straight out of Compton, it's a crazy brother named Ice Cube.
Yeah, N.W.A., everything from their name to their big hit, F the Police, very upfront, guns in the videos. And it woke up a lot of people to the realities of what was going on in L.A. specifically, but in the inner city in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm. In season two of Hip Hop Evolution, you take a road trip to explore the next generation of artists that came up in the 90s and developed identities and signature sounds for places besides New York City and L.A. What did you discover when you dug into the Miami sound or the Houston sound or Oakland?
So in Miami, you have this party culture. People love the bass. They love the sound of that coming out of their speakers and their clubs. It's a party culture. And then in the South, you have producers like Pimp C. You have groups like the Ghetto Boys that showcased like a Southern drawl for the first time in music, that brought in gospel kind of sounds and influences for the first time.
I make big money, I drive big cars, everybody know me. It's like I'm a movie star, but late at night, something ain't right.
And then in Oakland, you have this kind of Pimp and Mac thing going on the street side, so they like that sort of slick talk and storytelling.
Now as the record spins around, you recognize this sound, well it's the underground. You know that we're down with what you like, with what you like.
And then they also have the history of the Black Panthers there, so they have a level of social consciousness as well that's always there in the music. So Oakland has its own flavor. And that's really the story of hip-hop as it's produced different scenes and all these people brought just kind of new styles to hip-hop, new influences.
Yeah. In a review for Daily Dot, a critic named Caron Spearman wrote that it was unacceptable that your series didn't feature any women artists, not even crucial pioneers like Salt and Peppa, MC Light, or Queen Latifah. What's your response to his critique?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we know that was a big failure of the first season. Not that we didn't try, but you know, we weren't able to land some interviews with some of the major women that were there. Yeah, that was a huge failure of the first season, and we tried to, and we're trying to remedy that a bit the second season and so on. Yeah. Women have been around since the beginning of hip-hop, in the earliest crews, and that should have been represented in season one, and it's represented a bit more in season two.
Yeah.
Some think that we can't flow. Stereotypes, they got to go. I'ma mess around and flip the scene into reverse.
With what?
With a little touch of latest first.
When you sit down to interview one of your hip-hop idols, someone like Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest or Chuck D from Public Enemy, are you starstruck?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is I don't feel like I have to hide my inner fanboy because they're human beings too, and they're also amazed and surprised and delighted that they've been able to do such special things.
Jack DeBango is a hip-hop artist and the host of the Netflix documentary series Hip-Hop Evolution. His latest album is called A Short Story About a War. You can find out more at wpr.org/beta. Up next, Janet Murray tells us what analog media can teach us about digital storytelling. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. In 1997, Janet Murray published a book called Hamlet on the Holodeck, The Future of Narrative in Cyberspace. In this influential book, Janet explores how the computer is reshaping the stories we live by. 20 years later, she updated the book. She feels that the intro to the new edition could have simply said, "I was right." Janet has some ideas about how digital technology can be applied to a variety of areas, including journalism.
If you were thinking about journalism, for instance, I like the work very much of Nani de la Peña, who reproduces actual events in a very complex technological way. It doesn't seem real. It obviously is a computer-generated set of characters, but it uses real audio, and it places you in this very privileged witness position. And the effect of being in that witness position is a deeper, more intimate understanding in some way of this particular event. And the other thing that she's very good at, which a lot of the people who are experimenting with journalism are not so good at, is that she takes an event that has narrative compression to it, has dramatic compression. She takes an understandable dramatic moment. She doesn't just try to stick a camera in an exotic place and assume that you will learn something just by spinning around and looking at it. She picks a particular politically significant and dramatically moving moment, just like you would if you were writing a feature story, but then she puts you in the middle of it.
40% of homeless youth come from the LGBTQ community because they've been thrown out from their homes due to their sexual orientation. We ended up using the audio of Daniel Pierce, who was thrown out by his own family, and he happened to record the terrible confrontation that ensues.
Get off of me! What's wrong with you?
So by putting the audience in the middle of this physical moment, you know, using the motion capture, putting on digital characters, and then making it life-size so it happens all around you, it's so startling. Suddenly this thing you've heard, which is disturbing enough, and maybe you've watched videos of this type of scene, but if it's there and you feel physically vulnerable, you connect to Daniel and to what he's going through in a way that I don't think any other medium affords.
I think the hope of journalists is that committed journalistic practice like this could move people to action.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You taught the first ever course in interactive narrative when you were at MIT in the early 1990s, and now you're teaching interactive narrative at Georgia Tech. Is there one particular piece of digital storytelling that you've introduced to your students that has had a real impact on them?
I'll tell you one thing that I have been teaching pretty regularly in all that time, and that is Groundhog Day. Because Groundhog Day takes the same situation and repeats it, but it is really well designed to make the different versions comment upon each other and to be parallel. So we never lose our place in that day. We always know where we are in that day. And we never get bored that we're seeing the same thing happen, all of them, rather than just one of them, twice.
Well, what should we drink to?
To the groundhog.
I always drink to world peace. Well, what should we drink to?
I like to say a prayer and drink to world peace.
To world peace.
World peace.
Mmm, this is wonderful.
Sorry, can I tell you?
Mmm. How do you know so much about Punxsutawney?
I've spent a lot of time here. Small town people are more real, more down to earth.
That's how I feel.
Really? Would you like to try some white chocolate?
Yuck, it'll make me sick.
No white chocolate.
There is something so familiar about this.
Hmm?
Do you ever have deja vu?
Didn't you just ask me that?
It's really a masterful example that we are just learning how to do that with interactive storytelling, where we can segment the story that well and then juxtapose contrasting variants that pay off for seeing all of them rather than just one of them.
Yeah. I was delighted to see that in your book, you talked about one of the all-time great animated shorts, Chuck Jones' 1953 Daffy Duck cartoon, Duck Amuck.
And yes.
This is in a chapter on immersion. What does Duck Amuck have to do with immersion and digital storytelling?
Well, you see, that's another reference point that I turn my students to every year and that I have since the beginning of teaching this course. Again, it offers variance on a situation that shows you how far you get in dramatic expectations just by genres. So Daffy is in an animation where the animator is constantly erasing parts of the frame or substituting other backgrounds or other elements, formulaic elements, for the ones that Daffy has started to act with.
Hey, psst. Whoever's in charge here? The scenery. Where's the scenery? Stand back, musketeers. They shall sample my blade. Okay. Have it your way. Daffy Duck, he had a farm, E-I-A-I-O. And on this farm, he had an igloo, E-I-E-I-O. Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds?
So he's a pirate and he's a cowboy, and it shows you just how much you get from these props in terms of genre. But then, as you get to the punchline, which is more and more gets erased, and so the very structure of animation is called into question with the frames themselves, and you realize that it's Bugs Bunny who is playing this prank on Daffy, it asks you to think about, well, when do you lose belief that Daffy is actually there? And in fact, it's so skillfully done that you never lose belief that Daffy is there, no matter what is erased. And because we have such a long history with Daffy Duck, that his presence once established, it's not erasable by calling attention to the medium.
All right, enough is enough. This is the final, the very, very last straw. Who is responsible for this? I demand that you show yourself! Who are you? Huh? Am I a stinker?
Mm-hmm, Exactly. Very well said. It's like a Charlie Kaufman cartoon more than 50 years before Charlie Kaufman started writing screenplays. Yeah.
Yes. It's the same meta frame of mind. Exactly.
I'm curious, a lot of your students, I would imagine, they've probably never seen it before you screen it in class. What do they think of it?
They are fascinated by it, and they are familiar with anime and with comics. And they are familiar with that meta frame of mind because, as you say, it's current in a lot of other media frameworks. But the genre, and then they get the point about genre.
Mm-hmm.
Just giving them that idea of how much you can build from storytelling by signaling your genre allows us to have much more sophisticated interaction questions because it simplifies the process of making up stories.
Yes, because all these genres are very specific and they have their tropes and their rules.
Exactly.
You say that one way to understand the new digital narrative environment is through the metaphor of the kaleidoscope, and you reference an observation made by my fellow Canadian media visionary Marshall McLuhan that ties into this. What was it that McLuhan said?
He talked about the mosaic. So McLuhan called attention to something that is transparent to us now, which is the cognitive structure we needed in order to take for granted a newspaper. So a newspaper is a mosaic, as he points out. And of course, it's a mosaic that has headlines and leads and bylines and captions to pictures. It has all of these conventions that allow us to look at the front page and understand what's the most important story and what are the lesser important stories. And just what degree of importance it has by the size of the headline. But that we can look at the whole thing and things are going on in Italy and things are going on in Washington and things are going on in science and things are going on in entertainment. And we can take all of that in, which is very complicated frame of mind, to be able to take that in and as the ground, and then just look at the figure, you know, as the background, and then just look at the foreground of, oh, what is new?
Mm-hmm.
It's particularly relevant when you think about how news has moved to the digital sphere, how we had to reinvent those conventions very painfully over time, so that now we can look at the homepage of a newspaper, if we go to the homepage, and see the same kinds of information.
Yeah.
So the question is, how does a medium deal with complexity? How does it assimilate a lot of different pieces that then don't confuse us, but allow us to become more conversant about the world and make us more cognitively complex so that we get smarter as the media gets more developed. And my idea of what we need that's similar to that mosaic of the newspaper that McLuhan points out is a sense of a kaleidoscopic design frame for digital storytelling.
If we were to go old school, I'm just trying to make sure I understand this right. Say something from old school analog media. Would Akira Kurosawa's classic film Rashomon be an example of kaleidoscopic storytelling?
Yes. It shows the murder of her husband. And And that's a classic. But the thing about Rashomon is that the pieces are not as parallel as one might like. And the telling is not as compressed as one might like in an interactive form. So if you compare that to Groundhog Day, very different aesthetics in many ways,
mm-hmm.
that the storytelling has a different pace to it. And I think that in order for people to move between complicated stories, then you'd have to find something that has a pace somewhere in between Groundhog Day and Rashomon, you know, where the differences have that kind of moral physics of Rashomon. It's really important to see how the robber tells it versus how the woman tells it versus how the witness tells. But you can move among those different pieces more easily.
Janet Murray is a digital media professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She's also the author of the updated edition of Hamlet on the Holodeck, The Future of Narrative in Cyberspace. You can find out more about Janet at wpr.org/beta.
Hey, give me one sec.
What's going on here?
Oh, this is a program I wrote where you can battle an ogre in a samurai village. It's pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a badass fighter, but a game of really neat personality. Hey, dude, this is my buddy Ed.
Hey, Ed, nice to meet you. I'm Justin.
How are you?
Oh, great, super. Always, always such a treat to meet one of Gordon's friends.
So what's going on?
Gordon, I got a ship.
No freaking way!
The Orville, mid-level exploratory, and she needs a helmsman.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Are you ready?
Are you serious? Dude, I was born ready. This is crazy. Holy crap. Justin, we got ship.
I am so excited for you guys right now. I mean, do you just feel, like, so blessed?
We'll take a shuttle up at 0900.
Sweet. Oh, hey, Justin, you got a ladybug on you.
Aw, neat.
You win.
Nice.
That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to guest producer Brad Colbert.
You should sleep late, man. It's just much easier on your constitution.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
I wonder what that would sound like.
And our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Funky boss, get off my back!
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Where's that voice coming from? From nowhere?